morning in Jesus' name, and good morning from the small little church in San Antonio, Belize as well. Excuse me. Speaking of last week, you as a congregation lived up to your reputation as being very generous and hospitable hosts. And as you hosted the fellowship meetings there, you did an excellent, an excellent job of making it an environment that was comfortable, inviting, and a place where good discussions could happen. And I didn't get in on as much of the preaching as I would have wanted to, but if I had listened to my wife and drink as much water in the morning as I should, I wouldn't be in this trouble now, but here we are. And also, so I want to bless you for that and thank you for that. The cooks, I was thinking about this. I think most of the ones that were there cooking, the ones that were in charge, were maybe not even born yet when we left here 35 years ago. I don't know. You know how old you are. I don't know for sure. But things happen. I was looking at these numbers on the board here. Some of the numbers, like the top number, I don't think is that different than it was when we left. The second number is quite different than it was when we left. So things don't remain that static in some ways, even though I think the numbers were probably not that far. Probably the attendance when we left was 150, 160. I don't know that for sure. I don't remember. Anyway, so as far as the weekend, last weekend, was a time of great encouragement and challenge for me. It really was. To be there with all of you and the rest of the people that were there. So last weekend we were talking to the young people about foundations, and apologies to the young people because we have sort of the same title, but we're not so much talking to you. We're going shooting over your heads, not over your heads, behind you. I'm talking to your parents a little bit more about how they can, sort of the same things, how they can help you build those foundations, and especially when you're small. So when we think about foundations, that was the title last week, and I took the easy way out and decided to do a bit of a rerun with a little bit of a different emphasis than last week. So we still want to talk about foundations. Very simple things. Foundations are exactly that. They're foundational. They're basic. They're at the very bottom. They are the first thing. Something in the beginning, and they assume a building of some sort. We don't build foundations just for nothing. And so what are we building? We're building a life. One of the structures that got my attention recently was about less than a month ago, there's this boat on the East River in New York. You may have seen something about that. That Mexican Navy tall ship that was out on a training exercise. Actually, it was kind of a training goodwill exercise. The thing it was a sailing ship, but it was also powered, it had engine power, and it hadn't sailed since 1982, I think. But it was on a round-the-world goodwill tour, and it had spent some time in New York, several days there in New York City on the East River, anchored there. And then about a month ago, or it was less than a month ago, it was set sail for Iceland, I think it was going. Well, it somehow lost power. The tug that was moving it lost control. And the East River moves, it has a current that flows both ways with the tide. It's a very short little river. It's really not a river, but it's what they call it. So when the tide comes in, it moves one way, and time goes out, it moves another way. So as the ship lost power and they lost control of it, it was just swept along backwards right toward the Brooklyn Bridge. And there were people, it was kind of a, I don't know what they call this, but the sailors were standing up on the masts and all the way up there. And some of those sailors the masts were way too tall to go under the bridge. So as it went under the bridge, all three masts just snapped off. It was pitiful to see. So it's a beautiful ship just being broken like that. And then some of the sailors many of them were hurt. There were about 20 or so were hurt. Two of them were killed. It's kind of a sad thing. The bridge didn't budge. they're just as solid as could be. So I thought, think about that bridge. I think it was, just seemed pretty impressive, because we know a couple of years ago in Maryland, in Baltimore, a ship hit a bridge pillar, and the whole thing went down, just like that. And this bridge didn't do that. Well, it was a different kind of strike, too, as far as that goes. But anyway, I started thinking about this bridge, and I started looking at the Brooklyn Bridge, and I was thinking about foundations and stuff. So when they built the foundation of the Brooklyn Bridge, that was a long time ago. If Abraham Lincoln wouldn't have been shot, wouldn't have died prematurely, he might have had the opportunity to walk over that bridge, because it was started building just right soon after the Civil War. And the whole bridge today is 6,000 feet long, but the river itself at that point is only about 1,600 feet. So the main bridge there is about 1,600 feet, and it's built on two pillars. Two pillars that go up, and it's kind of a type of a suspension bridge. It's not a complete suspension bridge. But when they built that foundation, they used what they called caissons. And the caissons in this case were huge. They were 100 feet wide and 170 feet long, because they had two of them, one on one side, close to one side of the river, and one close to the other side. And they took those things, and it was like, a caisson is like an upside down box. So that when you used to take a bath when you were small, and you played in the tub, and you took a glass, your glass that you had in there, and you pushed it right down to the bottom of the tub. You know, you could keep water, the glass would be full of air. Even though it was completely underwater, it could be full of air. Don't you remember that, how that was? You didn't do that, okay. Well, you try it sometime. You don't have to go take a bath to do it, but just go put some, when you wash dishes, do it then. Put a glass upside down and push it right straight down, and you'll see that the glass stays full of air. It doesn't get full of water necessarily. If you push it right down against the bottom, it'll be full of air. Well, that's what these caissons were. They were like big boxes turned upside down. They pushed them to the bottom and then pumped, and then whatever water got in, they had steam engines, air compressors, and they pumped all the water out of all the water out, and then the boxes were tall enough that heavy, thick roofs, like 20 foot thick, made of yellow pine. The whole box was made of yellow pine, and they had enough room inside, like so kind of like a little building down there, where they would work inside, dig it out. Around the bottoms edges of the caissons was iron, so that when they dug around the edges, it would just work its way down. The weight of it would push it down, 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 and they would take out the dirt that was in there. They would take it out. They'd have ways of getting that out. Well, it wasn't good working conditions. They had to have high air pressure in there to keep the water out, and people got sick. They didn't know about. They call it caisson disease, I think. We call it decompression, or we call it the bends today, when your body's under pressure and you come out and get sick. Well, divers experience that if they're not careful. So they went down 70 feet or so on one side of the river, 78 feet on one side and about 45 feet on the other side, until they could get down to something solid enough that they could actually build pour concrete and bend and build pillars out. So I'm going to all that trouble to say that foundations, when you look at the Brooklyn Bridge today, it's been standing for since soon after the Civil War. It was finished in 1881, I think. And so that's still standing. They've done some revision on it and some work on it, because it was made for trains and horses, and today they're not using too many horses on the bridge anymore. They're using cars, and there might still be a railroad, I'm not sure. But so they've done some revisions and some remodeling on it, but it's still standing. It's a strong structure. It's a beautiful structure. But the foundation, they spent years building the foundation of that bridge. So we could look at other structures. You could look at, well, there's many structures that you know that are beautiful to look at, but would be nothing without the foundation. So we can conclude some things. We can conclude that foundations matter. In Belize City, I used to drive through this area every day. There's an area where probably about 30 years ago, some developers went in there and started building houses. and buildings, actually quite nice buildings, but without adequate foundations, obviously. Now it becomes obvious. It wasn't obvious then. But these buildings are at all sorts of angles. All kinds of ways that those buildings are. And they're kind of worthless. People are still living in some of them, but they're kind of worthless. A house, would you like to live in a house that if you know, your lunch pail would slide across the floor when you set it down? They're kind of worthless. And even though that they looked beautiful in their day and they were good otherwise, they just didn't have a foundation, and they're not really good for not really good for anything. We have 4 points we'd like to look at, but just a couple more thoughts before we do that. Foundations aren't seen. A lot goes into a foundation before you see anything on the surface. They're expensive, and they don't really make the building look better necessarily. You don't see the foundation, but without the foundation, the building gets ugly pretty soon. Other foundation can no man lay, and that is laid, which is Jesus Christ. That's what Paul tells us in Corinthians. So we have 4 points we want to look at, 4 foundations. And so, I'm aiming this at parents a little bit to help your... There comes a point when your children have to decide for themselves that they will claim this for themselves. They have to make that decision. They have to decide that they will claim these things. But you can, as parents, we can do a lot to make that much easier. We can start to teach them these things almost before they start to realize it. There's a verse in 2 Chronicles that I'd like to just start with. In 2 Chronicles chapter 21, verse 20. Really sad little verse here. And it's about King Jehoaz. And you just don't want this testimony. 32 years old was he when he began to reign. He was a king. This was in the days of Elijah or Elisha. I think it's don't remember which one of those kings, which one of those prophets it was. But it was. It says 32 years old was he when he began to reign, and he reigned in Jerusalem 8 years, and departed without being desired. What a testimony! He departed without being desired. You know what that means? Another translation says he departed with no one's regret. No one was sorry when he died. I don't know if you know anybody like that or not, but you don't want to be that person. You don't want to be that person that nobody is sorry when you're gone. Foundations have something to do with that. So if you want to help your children have foundations, teach them, have a good foundation. Teach them to fear the Lord. And now Israel. What doth the Lord thy God require of thee but to fear the Lord thy God, to walk in all his ways, and to love him, and to serve the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul. The Bible doesn't give us a description in any place that says this is what the fear of the Lord is. It doesn't say that this is a definition of the fear of the Lord. Exactly. But it does tell us what the fear of the Lord will do. It says the fear of the Lord prolongeth days, but the years of the wicked shall be shortened. And that's kind of interesting. That verses like that are sort of interesting because it's a promise to not so much us as individuals, but it's a promise to God's people. So those that fear the Lord in general, those that fear the Lord, they're going to live longer. Their days are going to be longer. They're going to have a better life than those that don't fear the Lord. Now, if you look at each one of us as individuals, it could be that it's almost too late for me to die young now, but not quite. So there's no promise that each one of us as individuals are going to, live long. But in general, God's people generally have longer productive lives. If you look, compare them with general society that doesn't fear the Lord. This is one of those verses that applies to God's people more than us as individuals. But one of the things it says, so what it says is the fear of the Lord prolongeth days. Another thing the fear of the Lord does, it says he will bless them that fear the Lord, both great and small, Proverbs 15, verse 33 says, the fear of the Lord will teach us to be wise. Psalm 27 says, the fear of the Lord is, or Psalm 19 maybe, the fear of the Lord is clean or pure. The fear of the Lord is wisdom, Job says. So when you think of the fear of the Lord, what comes to your mind as a parent? When you think of the fear of the Lord, what comes to your mind? The question is very basic, and it's often misunderstood. What does the fear of the Lord mean? There is a false fear. You know, when Israel was at Mount Sinai, and God showed himself in all his power and the thunder and lightning and smoke and fire and the noise like a trumpet that was so loud they couldn't take it. Those people fled from God. And you would have thought that they would have feared the Lord. But they said, I don't really want to get close. I want to, Moses, you go talk to God. But as soon as God disappeared, as soon as Moses went up the mountain and God was no longer thundering on Mount Sinai, not very long later, they built a golden calf. That is not the true fear of God. That's the kind of fear that many people have, though, that when they imagine God as a, or when they, you know, when God, if God would show himself in that kind of way, they would tremble and flee, but they would not obey him when he's no longer showing himself in that way. So true fear of God actually requires faith. It's when God isn't showing himself, but we believe God. And so the fear of God is recognizing that God is the creator. He is almighty. He's the creator. We're the creation. It is to be in awe. It's to be reverent, whether he is showing himself or not. Whether we, you know, there are times, I know that there are times that we've been to places where we could sense the presence of God. It was real. And the thought of doing something foolish or sinful would have hardly entered our minds. We'd have never dared do it because the fear of God, or with the presence of God, we could feel it. But what about when we don't? What about when it's not so evident that God is present, when we're not feeling that so much? The true fear of God keeps us reverent and in awe of him, even when it's not so manifest. It requires faith that God is here. God will sometimes maybe invade our space, come whether we ask him or not, and just be there, and we know that he's there. Well, he always is, but I'm, you know what I'm talking about, where we just feel it in a real way. Sometimes God might do that, but he doesn't do that often. And he wants us to fear him when he does that and when he doesn't. So to fear God is to give his, God waits to be recognized voluntarily. To fear God is to give him his proper place in our lives as creator and absolute authority, keeping in mind that he will have the final word. That's one thing about the fear of God, knowing that God will have the final word. The fear of God is when we recognize that our will must bend to his. He does not bend his will to ours. It's to be conscious of God. Proverbs chapter 8, verse 13 says, the fear of the Lord is to hate evil. And it says, in all thy ways acknowledge him. All these things help us to understand what the fear of God means. Fear of God means that there are boundaries that you will not dare cross. That's the fear of God. There is, you know, we don't want to think of God, the fear of God, as being afraid of God. But the word means that, the fear of God means that there are boundaries that you do not dare cross. When God says no, you don't dare do it because God said no. You don't dare. And in that sense, something very akin to the, I just won't do it. I would be afraid to do that. God said, no, I won't do it. I'm afraid to do that. Now, True, authentic, genuine fear of God is at the foundation of us being able to grow in our understanding of God and to grow in our love for Him. So that fear of God that is nothing but just being afraid of Him, like just that fear that we don't want to get close to Him, that's not a healthy fear. That's kind of like the Israelites had. But that fear of God that's genuinely afraid to do something He says not to do, or not to do something that He says we should do, that's good. That's a healthy fear. When God says, do this, and we say, well, you know, and we're not afraid not to do it, then that's not good. But the fear of God is the foundation, or prepares us to grow in our understanding of God and to grow in our love for Him. There is no authentic pursuit of Christ without genuine fear of God. And we can ask ourselves what comes first, whether we love God first and then we grow to fear Him, or whether fear comes first. I'm not sure if I'm qualified to answer that, but I feel like the fear of God, and when we really are in awe of Him, is when we can begin to love Him in the way that He wants us to. And I would say, thinking of teaching the fear of God to your children, it's probably not the best way to just talk to them about how fearsome God is. But the best way to teach the fear of God to your children is for you to fear God and to deal with them as God deals with you. So teach them the fear of God. Teach them to think right about authority. So I'm going to read some verses from the Bible here. And in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 1, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. And in Colossians 3:22, servants, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh, not with eye service as men pleases, but in singleness of heart, fearing God. Hebrews chapter 13, verse 7, obey them that have the rule over you and submit yourselves, for they watch for your souls, that must give an account, that they may do it with joy and not with grief, for that is unprofitable for you. Romans 13, verses 1 and 2, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. If we could teach our children to the proper concept, to respect, to think right, is what I want to say. To think right about authority. And that God has set things up. God has done it. God has set your parents up, you as parents, you have a right to impose some consequences. You have the responsibility to impose some consequences when there's disobedience. It's ridiculous for us to think that when God says, obey your parents, when He tells children to obey their parents, that He only means when it's something that's already written in the Bible. Of course He doesn't. Why would He say obey your parents if He's already written it, the same thing in the Bible? Of course. So He means that even though the Bible never says children wash the dishes, He just says it's the same as if He did. If your parents tell you to wash the dishes, it's the same as if God tells you to wash the dishes, because He said obey your parents. So we have the same thing with masters, we have the same with servants, we have the same thing with church leaders, and we have the same thing with government. We're way too free sometimes to say, well, I kind of make up my mind on some of this stuff. God says, obey them. Obey your parents, obey your boss, obey your authority. So if we teach our children, just early on, if we can teach our children to have the right concept of authority, that these things are set up by God. It's not just, it's for our good. So we're naturally resistant to authority, some more than others. You know who you are. And we often think there's a better way to do this. Sometimes we're openly resistant. Sometimes we're more manipulative in other ways. We just, you know, we have to do it. Most of us like to do it our way. Some of us are determined that in some way or another, we're going to have our fingerprint on it at least. It's going to be It can't be exactly the way the boss told me to do it. I'm going to have to change it a little bit, because otherwise, that's just how I am. I just have to change it a little bit. You've seen that, where no matter what it is, if you say it this way, if you know those kind of people. If you're told to do it this way, they'll want to change it a little bit. If they're told to do it this way, they'll want to change it a little bit. No matter how you say it to do it, they're going to change it a little bit. That's not really what God is calling us to. I'm not saying it's wrong to give suggestions by any means, but I'm just saying that this thing of resisting and always having to at least put my oar in a little bit into it. So obedience to authority is required. I made that point. But, however, blind, and this point was particularly for the youth, but we can help our children learn this at some point. Blind, unthinking obedience is not necessarily to be commended, partly because if you just do what you're told without understanding the reason why, without thinking why, you might never get the understanding. You might never understand the reason why. And also, when you are in a position of authority, if that's the way you've grown up, that you just did what you were told without understanding why and without trying to understand why, you just did it without thinking, without trying. I'm talking about trying to understand why you do what you do. What happens then? You never do learn it, and this is what you expect from your children then, is that they just do what you're told without understanding why, because you don't even know why. So learn why you do the things you do, and teach your children why you do the things you do as soon as they're old enough to understand. Don't be afraid of discussions. Don't be afraid of being asked why we do this. If you don't have a good answer, say, I don't have a good answer. I don't even know, but let's figure it out. We don't want to just do things that we don't even know why we're doing it. Figure it out, but have the discussion. But it doesn't excuse us as adults, or us as children, or for children, or whoever it is. It doesn't excuse us from being obedient to the things that we're required to do. But blind, unthinking obedience is what is not necessarily to be commended. Being in authority and being under authority are two sides of the same coin. What we mean is that authority is this thing here. Every one of us here this morning that's understanding what I'm saying is probably has some type of authority over something. Might be the rabbit, might be the dog. And in some ways, even your younger siblings, you have some authority over them. To a certain extent, depending on who you are, how old they are, how old you are, you do. Because what that means, when you are in authority, when you have somebody that is under you, that means that you have a certain responsibility for the well-being of that person. That if you are 14 and your sibling is 6, who's going to be in charge when your parents are gone? Well, it better be you. I hope it is. If not, your parents probably should have a conversation with the pastor or something. But it better be you if you're 14. What does that mean? That you get to boss him around? You get to make him do all the work? You get to, make him do your stuff while you sit around and do nothing? No, it doesn't mean that at all. It means that you are responsible for his well-being. You are an authority. You are responsible for his well-being. And so that's the other side. It's the same authority, but on one side, you're responsible for the well-being of that person. The other side is, when you're under authority, then when you're responsible to be submissive. But it's the same thing. So if we have a bad concept of one side, we'll also have a bad concept of the other side more than likely. The best thing you can do, maybe that's enough about that. So maybe the best thing we can do for our children is to love them, or maybe the best thing we can do for our children is to love their, is to love our spouse. That's a huge thing. And I apologized already to the youth a little bit for having to kind of go over some of the same stuff again, and I realized that I owe an apology to the parents too, because you heard some of the same you heard the same subject last week as well. I know they were talking about children. I wasn't there for that, but I know they were talking about child training and that stuff. So apologies to you as well, but we'll keep going. So the best thing you can do maybe for your children, or second best maybe, is to love them. But it's a measure of our love and our commitment to our children is how willing we are to invest in teaching them to obey. How much we're willing to invest in teaching them to obey, because it isn't easy. It's not an easy thing. It doesn't just happen by itself. So I'm just going to throw a few things out. When we're talking about teaching them to obey, and I'm talking about when they're pretty young. And I'm going to say that spankings were meant to hurt. In case somebody doesn't know that, spankings were meant to hurt. And not supposed to be a pleasant experience. And it's not a fight. It's not a fight. If your child hits back when you spank him, well, you know what to do. Meaningful spankings are the love language of children. And I hope you don't misunderstand me. I'm not advocating just beating. But a meaningful spanking is the love language of your child. When you spank him meaningfully and it hurts, he will know that you love him, you care for him. To whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth. No chastening is pleasant, is joyous, but grievous. And if your children aren't experiencing that, that it's grievous. That my disobedience is a grievous thing. It's a painful thing when I am punished. Just what the Bible says, that whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth. And I think it's the same way. I think it's a measure of our love, how much we're willing to invest in teaching them to be obedient. Spanking is by no means the only proper means of discipline, especially when they pass the toddler stage. I think that when you get to be 5, 6, you can start. I mean, I'm not going to put ages. You know when it is. But I'll say this. That little lap child, you don't have to explain a lot of things to him. You don't have to. You just make him listen. You're the boss. And if it takes a spanking, then spank him. If it takes two, then they take two. But you're the boss. And you need to make him listen. If you want to give him a good foundation. He needs to learn that there is such a thing as authority. There is such a thing where no means no. And your toddler doesn't care how you feel. Do you know that? You love them, they love you, but they don't. They're selfish. They don't care how they make you feel. They honestly don't. And so you try to explain that this makes mommy feel bad when you act like this. They don't even care. They're not. They're still gonna. They want what they want. Not every infraction needs a spanking. But when there's defiance, when there's backtalk, when they say no to you, then it's time for lightning to strike. So, number one, teach them the fear of the Lord. Teach them, number two, teach them about authority. Teach them to take responsibility. Sometimes in our efforts, and we've seen this many times in the culture that I live in now, many times we're in a generation where the parents, people my age, have struggled, worked hard, weren't even able to go to school a lot of times, or people, especially people a bit older than me, weren't even able to go to school very much because they had to work. And so they've determined that things are not going to be like that for their children. They're going to provide something much better for their children, and they've decided that their children will not struggle. And so they provide everything, and their children get everything, and they don't struggle. I mean, everything is provided for them. They don't work. They don't have to work. And it's not turning out that well. It's not really producing a generation of productive, good people. And so it's easy to do that. Children need to be taught responsibility. Life isn't easy. And there's a load for us to carry. That's how life is. There's no way to get through life just strolling. There's going to be difficulties of some sort. So if you can teach your children early on to bear some responsibility, you will help them. You will give them a good foundation. Teach your children to carry the load. How many 10-year-olds are here and 11-year-olds? I'd like to see how many 10 and 11-year-olds are here. All right, several of you. How many of you like to wash the dishes and, well, do chores? Wash the dishes, carry out the garbage, feed the dogs, all that boring stuff. How many of you love it? It's your favorite thing to do. Nobody likes it. How many of you have to do it anyway? Thank your parents. That's good. So nobody... Well, life is just about, there's a lot of boring work in life. There's a lot of things that, just like washing the dishes, feeding the dog, all that stuff, it's not that exciting. But when we learn to love our work, how much time does your dad spend working? Let's see, who wants to tell me that? How many hours a week, guess? Let's go in about this fourth bench back. How many hours a week, roughly, would your dad spend working, you think? 40? 50? 60? A lot of time. It doesn't really matter how long it is. It's a lot of time. And suppose he hated his work. 50 hours a week. So miserable. What a miserable life that would be. But when your parents teach you to do your work, even if you don't like it, they're teaching you to learn to like to work. And pretty soon you start thinking about how well you can do it and what's the better way to do it and how fast I can do it and still do it good. And you learn to like your work. Your dad isn't working 50 hours a week on a job he doesn't like because he likes his work. I'll bet you. So if you learn to like to work, is what I'm saying, you learn to like to work, then you spend your life doing things you like, most of it. So but it's something we need to learn. So parents could teach our children, we need to teach our children to look around us and see beyond themselves and make somebody else's load lighter. Look around you. So this is very practical. But when you go to somebody's house, this is something for parents to teach their children. When you go to somebody's house and you're not there, teach them to offer to help. You know, there's always work to do. You know, if you're there for lunch, there's dishes, always offer to help. Is there something I can do? And then if somebody asks you that as a parent, if some other young person comes in, your children's friends, and they offer help, give them something to do. Don't be afraid that they're going to break something. Just help teach them to take responsibility. Let your children take some consequences for their mistakes. Life isn't about, you're not doing your children a favor by trying to help them avoid every single mistake. There's some mistakes that it's okay if they make and learn from it. There's some mistakes we shouldn't make. But there's some mistakes that it's okay to let your children make, and it's not all about never making a mistake. But then the consequences for it. You know, we don't try to shield your children from the consequences of their mistakes. They need to own them, because we can learn from our mistakes, but only if we own them. I have one more point here, and it's time to close, but I'll move through this quickly. And that is, so we had three. We have fear of the Lord, respect for authority, or teaching the right way to think about authority, take responsibility, and sacrifice. Sacrifice is so foundational to the Christian life, because without the sacrifice of Christ, giving himself, there would be no such thing as a Christian experience. And so the whole idea of sacrifice is to willingly lay down or give something that is yours, or that give up something that is yours or that potentially could be yours. To willingly give it up. That could be possessions. It could be plans. It could be time. Now, as a parent, if you're going to be a good parent, you will make some sacrifices. If you're going to do a good job on the food committee, you're going to make some sacrifices, or on the school board, or youth sponsor, or trustee, or whatever you do, or a pastor. You will make sacrifices to do a good job in any of those things. And it's okay if your children make some sacrifices too, because of your responsibility. It's okay if they do. It's not necessary to think that my poor children, they have to put up with so much because of my responsibility. My poor children, let them make some sacrifices. Now, within reason, obviously, you don't. So it's like this. Your children are your primary responsibility, but they're not your only responsibility. So ask the Lord, how do I do this? And there are times when the most important thing for you to do will be to be with your children. There are times when the most important thing for you to do is to do whatever it is, whatever else your responsibilities are. So you don't just, it's okay what I'm saying. It's simply okay for your children to learn to make sacrifices because of the responsibilities that you have as well. We're not talking about being neglectful, but again, I'm going to repeat, your children are your first responsibility, but they're not your only responsibility. So a child who has never learned to sacrifice and has always had everything he wanted handed to him is in real danger of growing up to be a spoiled, selfish, entitled individual who nobody wants to have around. He'll be like that person that in Second Chronicles, when he goes, nobody's going to miss him. And you don't want that. So there are many, many things that our children will learn throughout their lives, but these four things will give them a great foundation to build on. And if you can, and the thing is that by the time they get to be 15, 16, when they start making these, or whatever, at whatever point that they decide that they want to take some responsibility, they want to fear the Lord, they make those decisions for themselves, you'll have given them a huge head start if you've taught these things almost without them knowing. Well, yes, without them even understanding when it began, you'll give them a huge blessing, and they will bless you for it.